So what I'm going to be talking about is what I'm going to be putting together for my dissertation proposal. And it will be basically a computational model of linguistic rhythm. So I'm going to basically start with, I'll start with talking about sort of my underlying intuitions and why I think this is an interesting question, then talk about what linguistic rhythm is and isn't, and then talk about two kind of major fields of research in rhythm that I'm hoping this is going to tie together. First, with my underlying intuitions, these are things that I've kind of, that are not necessarily traditional views in linguistics that have prompted me to be looking at this question. And that the first is that somewhere between the actual speech signal that people are producing and low-level perception, that somehow there's kind of a discretization of time going on there in a psychological fashion, and that timing is imposed on the real time of the signal, and that moreover that time, that linguistic time, is more relevant to speech recognition than real time. So as opposed to the engineering approach for speech recognition, in which you just have this window that's like sliding across in real time, windowed in milliseconds, that to me seems like the wrong approach to modeling anything that humans are doing. And then moreover, not all segments are created equal. So what that means to me is that in the speech signal, portions of the speech signal carry more information than others. That is essentially vowels carry most of the information, most of the intensity of the signal, and therefore to me are going to be more salient in terms of recognition than other aspects of the signal.
In terms of recognition or in terms of locking into linguistic time?
Both,
okay.
I would say.
When the point of locking into linguistic time would be not to just lock into linguistic time, but in other words, linguistic time should be for something other than just timing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a long-standing tradition of talking about rhythm, and it's been historically based on this perception that languages are different, are temporally organized differently. And so some of the early characterizations of that were that Italian has a machine gun-like rhythm, whereas English has kind of like a Morse code rhythm, which is getting at this idea that English has stress that elongates, gives a higher pitch and loudness to specific syllables, and the rest are sort of just carried on afterwards. So if you say differently, there's one stress syllable and then a whole bunch of other, maybe secondary stress, but mostly schwas. And that does give us a lot in a lot of sense. Like it's not like that's unmotivated. So for instance, just anecdotally, if you look at versification, i.e. poetry, in languages that are prototypically belong to different rhythm categories, I should say, I think I've got the next. So there's traditionally three recognized rhythmic types, that is stressed, like in English, syllable timed, like in French, and mora timed, which is a language like Japanese. And if you look at the poetry of those three, the native poetry of those three languages, Japanese has haiku, which is based on mora, and a mora is a subsyllabic timing unit such that a syllable like tan has two moras in it, because coda nasals in Japanese have their own mora, and they're longer than a non-coda one. So if it was in the onset like a ni, that the consonant in ni would be shorter than the one that has a mora at the end of tan. So haiku is based on that. In French, sonnets are based on syllables, and English, a limerick is a native English poetry style,
and it's
irrelevant.
Oh,
for
you mean haiku? The version you're laughing is haiku sonnet limerick.
Limerick.
English has sonnets too.
I know. Which was my next
and
point.
And haiku for that matter.
But it's not native to English.
Yeah.
So that doesn't. It's not that we can't write haiku and syllables in English, but it's not. It wasn't natively enough. And I think it kind of too intuitively makes sense because English speakers. I think it's easier for us to kind of spontaneously get the feel for a limerick than for a sonnet. And so instead of sitting there counting, trying to count syllables, like if we're writing haiku, you're sitting there counting with your fingers all the time, and Japanese people who are skilled at writing haiku just like, because it fits with their intuitive understanding of rhythm. So
can I put an anecdotal bit of information in
sure.
here? You know, there are tone deaf people, right, who can't sing
mm-hmm.
on key. It seems to me that there are limerick deaf people too. And
really?
We had a limerick writing contest a few years ago for a connectionist meeting, and it had to be a connectionist oriented limerick. And there were people who submitted things to this that weren't limericks at all, and they were native speakers of English. That is, they had way, way too many syllables. You know, and it
really?
Looked as if they hadn't figured out the pattern, which seems like a very simple pattern mm-hmm. in a way, so that you can easily recognize one. I think there were people who could recognize it, but who just couldn't produce
one.
They just, and there'd be, you know, four too many syllables in the line. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out, and I wonder if there's a. I don't think it'll come out of your dissertation. It just didn't work. I didn't ever do any deep analysis of it. It just, you know, you listen to it and you say. That's not right.
That's not
even a poem.
But native speakers of English sometimes don't even agree on what is a syllable or what not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is something we're going to come to.
Probably. Okay.
It's going
anyway,
we're
going
to come to. No problem.
Close to break, so.
But the underlying assumption between rhythm is that it implies isochrony of some sort. When you say that English is stress timed, kind of the implicit claim that you're making there is that in English, stresses occur more rhythmically than, say, syllables or mora. And by the same token, when you say French is syllable timed, you're saying that that syllables occur at regular intervals in French, and more so than English or Japanese. And that turns out not to be true. If anything, Japanese is the closest to being periodic in that sense, in that moras are very rigorously the same length, regardless of, well, there's some exceptions, but for the most part, if you know the number of mora there are in an utterance, you know exactly how long the utterance is. but it's definitely not true for English and not true for French. So this recent fact that came along, people were blithely going along with the assumption and the perception that things occurred at regular intervals. When they started realizing that wasn't true, people started looking at other factors that could be giving us this phenomenon. And there's a researcher named Ramu and a whole bunch of his colleagues with a big list of references that have started looking for three factors. That underscore is supposed to be a delta Mac transfer problem.
Windows transfer problem.
Yes, a Windows transfer problem. I'm sorry. I apologize.
But it's actually a PowerPoint issue, right?
Yeah, you would. It shouldn't.
A font thing. If you embed the font, then you don't have it, I think.
Right, and I thought I had dealt with it, but I guess.
Okay, so where's the delta?
So the delta is anywhere there's an underscore.
Oh, okay.
So that should be a delta. What they examined were these three factors, the percent V, which means the portion of the signal that's vocalic, and that's just a straight percentage. If you measure the vocalic intervals, then, and what percentage of the entire length of the speech stream is that. Delta V is the variation in the length of the vocalic intervals. So if you measure all the vocalic intervals in an utterance, and then that value is going to be the difference in sort of the maximum and the minimum. Although I am a little bit confused with their their notation. I think that's what it is, but they call it standard deviation, but then they also give you a standard deviation for it. So
standard deviation of it over time?
Right. They call delta V and delta C standard deviations, but then also give you a standard deviation of it, of both of them, which is a little bit strange. So I think it's just an absolute variation.
What do you mean, absolute variation?
I think that they're measuring in milliseconds. They don't, so just the maximum versus the minimum that they get in their utterances.
That makes sense if they're calling it delta.
Yeah, it would. And then likewise, delta C is the variation of in the length of consonantal intervals. So that gives you basically a three-dimensional space in which you can plot various languages. They looked at 8 languages total. And then you can project that into 2 dimensions in 3 different ways. The first way with percent V and delta C gives a really quite nice characterization of what would be classical rhythm. Japanese is way down at the bottom, all alone. French, Spanish, Italian, and Catalan sort of cluster together in the center, and English, Dutch, and Polish make another cluster up in a different part of the space. And those differences in the clusters are all significant, and within the clusters are not. So at first they took this as being then delta C and percent V as being the most important. There are two other projections though. And again, they kind of cluster together, but interestingly, Polish falls out of that cluster with English and Dutch.
Well, maybe if they had taken some more Slavic languages, they would plot another cluster.
That was the question that they decided to ask. At first, they were like, "Well, it doesn't really matter. We'll just." They thought that delta C and percent V were the only ones relevant. But then they did some perceptual studies and determined that, in fact, speakers are able, if you resynthesize the speech, retaining only the rhythmic properties, basically these, then speakers can distinguish between Polish and English based solely on those facts, whereas they can't between English and Dutch.
Do they know which one is which, or can they just distinguish them?
They can just distinguish them. I'm not sure if they actually asked the question, if they can. That's a good question.
And are those native speakers of one or the other language? Or
yes, I think they were English speakers primarily. I'd have to check it again. Interestingly, one thing that bothers me a little bit about this is that you see the location of Japanese is sort of in the middle on the delta V variation. So page won't go up. And then again there, suggesting that it has a lot of variation in vowels, right? And that's because Japanese has a contrast between short vowels and long vowels. And long vowels in Japanese have 2 mora assigned to them.
Oh.
And so they
really
just kind of glossed over that.
Really a binary function.
It is. And you can see that in that, like, you see the error bars on English giving you like the standard deviations for how much there's variance there. And in the Japanese, it has less variance even than the Polish, which is on this graph the lowest one. But the variation, like the error bars, are the smallest. And what that's suggesting to me is that the Japanese data kind of looks like that, which is going to give you a small standard deviation in this when you try to do the statistics on this, versus the Polish, which is probably something more like that. You're frowning.
Isn't delta V like I mean, I don't know what it's an maximum in over, like maybe one speaker or something like that. And then when you look at the standard deviance between speakers, maybe, or between utterances or something?
No, my understanding is that they had about 20 speakers of each.
Okay.
And they put them all together.
They put them all together to give one delta V, then there couldn't be a standard deviance.
So how did they, but also how did they decide what's a vowel and what's two vowels?
They didn't.
Did they do it by machine?
They didn't.
Somebody has to decide, right? So
no, they didn't. They didn't distinguish between one in Japanese. They didn't distinguish.
No, it's between one vowel and the next vowel. Between what and what? How do they decide what's a vowel and what?
On
where one vowel ends and another vowel begins. Right?
They wouldn't. If it's just continuous, like there's got to be a break in voicing.
Okay, that's how they.
Right.
That's
right.
And that's. Somebody listening to it and saying, oh, I heard a break in voicing, or...
No, they based on spectrograms. They produce a spectrogram and then follow.
There isn't a break in voicing if there's a voiced consonant between two vowels.
Right, but there's a significant difference in the intensity of the voicing.
Okay, something like that
right.
is what they use.
Right.
So there would be no way they would take she and turn it into two vowels.
No.
Just because it's long.
No, because it's long. So in their kind of like dumb algorithm, it's not going to just distinguish between that. And that
but
I think is...
That doesn't seem dumb at all. I mean, because no one's going to hear that as two vowels, I don't think.
Right. Right. And so I think it's important that for Mora timing, and maybe it'll be clearer why later, that this distribution kind of would look like this, I think. There's probably a lot more regular length vowels in Japanese than or short vowels.
Vowels, because you wouldn't want to average it together and say, oh, well, there's a lot of variance in length.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, but naively you would, because how would you know?
Right. Right.
But if it's really bimodal, then that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
If you know there were ones that are exactly twice the length of others.
And I'm pretty sure that it would be.
Which is what it's supposed to be.
It should be. They didn't give me this data though, unfortunately. But I'm sure that that's what it would turn out to be. So really, if we were kind of taking this into account, I think like the Japanese should be down here, and it would look a lot more like that first graph.
How is English related to this? I mean, I guess I want to know for each of the languages, is there some sort of peak structure that would be interesting?
I doubt it. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. Like English is pretty all over the place. It's even just vowels in English have inherent lengths in and of themselves. So,
right.
So like, a in American English is typically produced longer than
right.
E.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I mean, I guess my intuition is the same, but I wonder if you find that, and I'm sure if you wouldn't, but I wonder if you would find if you did it for each vowel individually, and you found each of those vowels have a very constant length,
mm.
So you still want to have as much variation in the length of the vowel.
Except that for the vowels, that can appear in different kinds of stresses, and not all vowels can.
Yeah.
There are supposed to be at least three levels of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so those vowels might have three lengths.
Right.
Maybe
right.
It could be trimodal.
Right. Right. But my suspicion would be that it isn't.
Okay.
There's some people looking at.
It'll come back.
Okay. People looking at a wide range of languages now, and not all of that research is back. And there's some really interesting questions in things like Finnish, which has contrastive vowel length, but isn't Mora timed like Japanese.
Okay.
So off the top of my head, my suspicion would be that what's going to end up being the case is that they're going to have like a bimodal distribution like Japanese, but that the distribution is going to be different. And maybe more variation in there. But that's all speculation. So basically the upshot of it is, at the moment, just these three factors together are making some really interesting predictions about Polish, for instance, that are being held up, and it also gives us reason to maintain our classical kind of categories of Mora syllable and stress-timed languages. By providing some sort of reason why those cluster together. So let's step away from that for a minute and look at this other completely different area of research in segmentation, and that is said rhythm being used for the task of segmenting the speech stream into words. So Ann Cutler and all of her colleagues, with an even longer list of references over the last 10 years, have been studying the question of how rhythm type impacts on the way we parse words out of the speech stream. And they're coming from basically an acquisition point of view, because most of the models of parsing have been based on adult speakers who already have a very rich lexicon, and there's kind of a pattern matching approach to it. But if you have a naive listener, like an infant, they obviously don't have that lexicon to draw on, and so they're asking the question, can you use rhythm as a way of bootstrapping into those early ages of early stages of parsing, to acquire your first words. So the first thing that they discovered was something called the syllable effect, and basically it's a spotting task where the speakers will hear a word and they're asked to respond whether or not a target syllable was in that word. And they are faster at finding ba in balance than they are in balcon, but at the same time they're faster at finding bal in balcon than they are in balance. And the argument is because in balance you have a syllable boundary here, and in balcon you have a syllable boundary there, and so because these syllable boundaries are already matching what the target is, they're faster, they can recognize that faster. Okay. And so you get this interesting crossover effect in the response times, in which if the target is CVC or CV syllables and the context is CV or CVC, then you get the response time for this is low but high over here, and high over here, and low over here. Okay. Interestingly, this doesn't show up in English at all. In fact, they use the word stubbornly absent, which I kind of liked. And moreover, it's been really rigorously reproduced, even with nonsense words, even with non-French words. So the same effect shows up whether they're listening to French, English, Japanese, whatever.
But what is the reason for it? I mean, for these two words, balance and balcony, wouldn't we segment the syllables in balcony? Wouldn't it be bal?
Well, the English words are segmented like that.
No, then most people would argue that they are, but I think the point is that syllables don't matter so much for English.
They don't matter to us.
They don't really care about, the syllable isn't the basic unit.
Right. And so what the argument is that French segmentation of the speech stream is proceeding in terms of syllables. And so if you're going through parsing that and you've already chunked it as being val, lance, then it's easier to do the recognition task. Whereas in English, where we're not chunking it into syllables like that, it doesn't matter. And in fact, English people are equally good at both. So you can take the French words or English words, and English people will not be any faster recognizing either of those in either words.
So how do the English people, how do they chunk a word? How do they chunk words?
Or let's say it's more of a question of where you put boundaries. And in English, there's an effect of stress, which has been kind of mashed in a little bit with strong versus weak syllables, which is what these two examples are. But basically, they found in English, if you give English speakers a target of mint in a similar spotting task, if you hear mintish, in which there's primary stress here, and this is a so this is a strong syllable. This is just a weak syllable that's either schwa or e. Compared to mintave, in which you've got at least probably secondary stress here, primary stress here, and in both cases strong vowels. So these are both strong syllables. English, they've shown, has a, that shouldn't even, see even the way I wrote it. That was totally not intentional, but indicative of the way we're carving up this word. English speakers have a bias for placing boundaries. Sorry. That's why I wanted to put the T in there, because it should belong to both. Boundaries before stressed syllables. So they would have a boundary before here and a boundary before here. Whereas here, there's just going to be a boundary here. So we don't have any problem recognizing this in here, in mintish, because we haven't placed any kind of a boundary there, not even really probably a syllable boundary, because we're not bothering to think on a syllable level. Whereas here, we did place a boundary here, and it's harder for us to then pull that t back off of the second syllable and put it back on the front. Okay.
Why think you're not placing a boundary after the t, you're placing a boundary after the t, so mintish?
Were these artificially generated?
I don't think so, no.
Because a lot of
but they did
would aspirate the t in the one case,
right,
and not in the other.
And then they examined that, and they went through, and they did another test afterwards with their data and cut off the second syllable and showed that speakers couldn't tell the difference based solely on that.
Are you recording what you said earlier?
Yep.
Oh. I'm sorry.
Bye. Bye. So, okay. And also, there's a lot of data from missegmented. Whoops, I missed this one. And also, you can show that this task of when you've got the strong together and it doesn't coincide with the syllable boundary, you can compare that with thin in thin-type or thin-tef, where the target doesn't require a resegmentation of that boundary, and they're no slower at any of these three, only that one. Is that clear?
No. I missed the fintape.
Sorry.
Is that different from mintape and mintape? Mintape.
Because in this one,
I can't see any of those.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just believing that.
Okay. The difference is that in fintape and fintef, the imposed boundary is not requiring. It's because it coincides with the syllable structure. You don't have to try and take that first consonant and put it back on.
Why is fintape different from mintape?
Because
fin-tape.
The target is only thin with just one consonant after it.
Oh,
whereas
the target
mint,
is thin. Sorry.
Right. Target is thin. Sorry.
There it is, right there.
So, and in missegmentations, people tend to put English speakers always put boundaries before stressed syllables, so instead of, you can manipulate them into making missegmentations, and they would more likely say something like invests with stresses on the second syllable and misunderstand that as being invests, then they would do something, do the opposite. And likewise, they're more likely to delete a word boundary before a weak syllable, as in bird in being misunderstood as burden. Okay. Likewise, in Japanese, we have a similar phenomena going on, where native Japanese speakers can find ta in tanishi faster than they can in tanshi. And by the same token, they can find tan faster in tanshi than in tanishi, where the mora boundaries coincide with each other. So ta is one mora, ni is one mora, shi is one mora, versus ta, n, shi, in which, again, ta is one mora, n is one mora, shi is one mora. And when they have difficulty cutting this consonant off of in when it's not coinciding with the mora boundary.
Kay. So is tan one mora too?
No,
tan is two moras.
Okay.
Ta is one mora. Also, if there, so ta is just a syllable target. Uni is an actual word, and in various contexts, as long as the mora boundaries coincide, as in ya nuni, in which that n is actually a, it might not look like it, but
gyan,
it's gyan uni. So this is right. It's like that. And gauni both have mora structures that allow you to segment out that uni, but they interestingly completely fail to find it in gyabuni. They won't find it at all. Moreover, native English speakers, if you give them the Japanese words, they have no problem on any of these tasks.
Meaning, no, they don't distinguish the different.
They're no faster at.
Okay.
They're no slower at finding ta or tan in tanshi or
yeah.
Tanishi, or finding uni in gyabuni. And native French speakers show the same crossover effects, given the Japanese data, that you would see if they were listening to French or English. So this effect of rhythm, even though we don't really know what it is, does seem to really play a role in all these circumstances, and it's more than well documented and repeated. However, there's no one has ever suggested a link between these at all, and it's fairly recent anyway, so that's probably not a surprise. But there's still a question of what these factors, percent V, delta V, and delta C, have to do with segmentation, because it's not immediately clear why it is that the variation in vocalic intervals and consonantal intervals are going to impact on segmentation at all, right? So the question that I want to ask is, can you build a naive adaptive model that's only responsive to percent V, delta C, delta V, and have it produce behavior that's consistent with segmentation based on these rhythm types? And this is how I'm hoping to do it. To be able to track percent V, delta V, and delta C, you need to have two points consistently indicated in the model, or in the speech stream. Basically the vocalic onsets and the vocalic offsets. So this is an English word spectrogram that's a little bit dim, but essentially this is one vowel, this is the word birthday, it's one, the first R and the second A, and you need to be able to indicate where the onset of a vowel is, where the offset of a vowel is, where the onset is, and the offset is, to track this. And that will give you delta V and delta C, because if you are in some way measuring and then averaging over time the vocalic intervals and the consonantal intervals, then you can easily determine the variation in those. Likewise, what I sit on there. So the idea that I have is to use those sort of spikes, if you can imagine them being spikes in a spiking neural network model, using those spikes to drive adaptive oscillators. Although I'm now waffling a little bit and thinking about some other possibilities. But we'll stick to talking about oscillators.
Other possibilities.
You're getting stressed?
Yeah.
It was a thought I had last night when I was writing this up, so
it
may not be
it
that
late,
serious.
Right?
It was late.
The spectrogram is given, and there's a program that finds those red lines.
It's not really that difficult, actually. Like, you can just filter it down, and the energy, like vocalic intervals, are characterized by high energy in the fundamental frequency.
And
so
what happens when two vowels are one after the other?
This would be the same as like Ramu's stuff. You wouldn't. So for instance, in Japanese, like the long vowels, you wouldn't have any distinction between those.
Mm.
However,
or two different vowels together.
Right.
Right,
or two
I
different vowels. Right.
I.
Right. Absolutely. and that. So that's why I think that this particular distribution of Japanese that I thought was there is important, because if you have more than. Let me come back to that after I've talked about more of what the idea is. So if you have an oscillator that is measuring essentially the length of vocalic intervals, it's not likely going to, it's certainly not in English, it's not going to find the periodicity that it wants to find. It's going to be going all over the place. But what it is doing is each time it comes around, it's making a prediction of where it thinks where the vowel is going to end, for instance. And if it if it's wrong, that difference is inherently giving you a measure of what kind of variance there is in the length of vowels. So, and likewise for the consonants. But moreover, if you take those two oscillators, the difference in their period is going to be a measure of the percent of the vocalic periods of the signal. Because if they're close to being equal, it means that in general you've got as long a consonantal period as vocalic periods, meaning it's about 50-50. Does that make sense? So just given those two bits of information, which are relatively easy to get out of the signal, and also there's good evidence that we may even like process vowels and consonants differently cognitively. So there's strong evidence to suggest that we're sensitive to that difference, even as infants. I just said that. Whoops. Where have I gone? Sorry, I just lost my train of thought. Where was I? Okay. Da-da-da-da. So we've got this. Yes. The next bit that I'm suggesting is that those three factors in turn give you an estimate of the size of an attentional window around the signal that you're looking at right now. And what that attentional window is just a metaphor for the stimulus decay. So if you play someone a tone, there's an immediate response and then a decay of information. And what I'm suggesting is that we don't have a processing window that just slides right across the speech stream continuously, that we use rhythm somehow to sort of say, this is an important point to look at in the signal, this is an important point to look at in the signal, this is an important point to look at in the signal. So in that way, you're taking continuous real time and almost sort of discretizing it somehow rhythmically. And that given those factors, if those factors are, if there's a lot of variation, you, I'm sorry, if there's very little variation, you can afford to have that window smaller because the information that you need to recognize will be within the time that you need it to be. Whereas in English, so that would be the case of Japanese. Whereas in English, where there's a lot of variation, you need to somehow keep that window wider temporally, so that you don't know whether you're getting a CV syllable or a CCCVC syllable, and you just need to keep the window wide so that you're receptive to all of it. Okay, and so I'm suggesting that those boundaries on the window are a better gauge of what the boundaries and the rhythm are going to be. So as a, that's just a summary, that the smaller that those values are, and the more periodic the rhythm is going to be, and the narrower your window can be, as in the case of Japanese, and vice versa, in the case with English. And hopefully, if I provide this model with just speech, that it would settle on a window size that is indicative of the rhythm type. And that shouldn't have gone like that. Okay. Another PowerPoint failure. Basically, the first one that you can see underlying the bottom, if you were looking at a word like tanshi, the narrowest case with only would be, sorry, if these were the windows, the narrowest windows would correspond to each of these three segments, whereas if it was a little bit wider, a little bit less regular, like French, it would be more like the syllable length, and English would be longer, encompassing a large portion of the word. Interestingly, this also predicts that because the window size is large, but you're also targeting, because the window size is so large, I think it's likely in English you end up with a lot of overlap between them. So that to me is a good reason why we would expect in English to have ambisyllabicity, like you were mentioning, because if our receptive windows that are kind of correlating with syllables, because they're simultaneously kind of targeting stressed or stressed syllables, stronger syllables, and if they overlap, then in a word like happy, you're going to be having two receptive windows that are trying to grab onto that consonant at the same time. I think that's on my next slide. That's my second point on there. It's also, I think, consistent with this widely noted correlation between rhythmic type and consonant cluster complexity. So languages like Japanese that are mora languages can't have more than CV and a possible nasal at the end. There's sometimes a glide in there too. And I would suggest that part of the reason for that is because if this window is so small, you just don't have the room to stick anything else in there. Whereas if there's more variation, like in English, you can pack as much in there as you want, because your rhythm type is allowing for it. Another thing I'm hoping to come out, one open question is whether or not there are these actual categories, or whether or not the removes nice categories that fall out are just an artifact of selection, because English, French, and Japanese are the prototypical languages for those categories. So if you're picking languages like that to try and see if they're going to categorize the same way, then they're likely to.
There were only about 8, right?
Right, there were only 8. So there's a question whether or not as they look at more languages, which they are doing right now, whether we're going to see that clustering still or whether or not we're just going to get a spectrum.
But still, it could fall on lines within the space rather than just being anywhere.
True. But Polish being off
there
is suggesting that there might be more variation than we'd expect. But either way, this I think would have some interesting things to say about that, because if you've got oscillators, there's a potential for the dynamics of that system to give you attractor states, and it would be nice if those attractor states sort of fell out and corresponded nicely to categories. I'm not sure that would happen, because they're not actually in training on anything, so that would be an open question for me, but it's a possibility. I think that this also suggests some interesting predictions as to how you could manipulate the tasks to see if you get different behavior out of different speakers. So specifically, if you could take an English speaker and give them something like one of Bob's speech cycling tasks, which is imposing a stronger rhythmic structure on the stimulus, it would be interesting to see if you could get them to produce something more like syllabic segmentation. And the other nice thing about this is that it would be a completely like language independent mechanism by which this is occurring, and it's pretty relatively simple. There is one problem I can think of off the top of my head that I don't know how to deal with, and that is that even bilingual, like perfectly bilingual speakers show a bias that correlates to the language. The question that they asked them was, which is the language that you would regret losing the most? As a measure of sort of which one was their more preferred language. And those bilingual speakers, both of whom grew up in, all of whom grew up in like very bilingual, like from birth, still showed a bias to one or the other processing. The one that they liked. So if you said you'd regret losing French, you showed the crossover effect on English and French data. And if you regretted losing English, then...
It's really the rhythm that you regret losing.
Yeah, I guess so.
Really what matters.
But so that is kind of a problem, because there's these two groups of people that have like more or less equal exposure to the languages, certainly as far as acquisition is concerned, and yet somewhere along there something gets fixed. And so that I'm not sure how, because this is so adaptive, hopefully, then that would be a big question. Right.
One question. You mentioned those window widths earlier, different for different languages.
Right.
So how would babies acquire those, learn those widths?
Same way that this would. All it is just... This is meant to model babies, essentially. All it's doing is just responding to those intervals, which we know that they're... It's like it's determined by those intervals.
Okay.
It's hardwired to look for
right.
boundaries, vowel boundaries, right?
Right.
To look for beginnings and ends of vowels.
Right.
And what it's trying to find is the regularities.
Right.
So it seems to me that another way to portray this the goal is to actually come up with a way of really defining what these differences are, because, as you know, maybe the rest of you don't, it's been very hard for people to even talk about these distinctions. There are still people who don't believe in it, who will say that there's no such thing as rhythm and language.
Right.
It's just an illusion, because when you try to actually measure these things in languages and prove that English has any kind of periodicity at all, you fail to find it. There is no such thing.
Right.
No. And yeah, you can, in the lab, you can do things like Bob's experiments, where you ask people to perform things that force them to be rhythmic, and then look for where the rhythm is. But then you go out and listen to people talking like me now, and try to measure things, and you don't find it. So there are people who say, no, this is just, it's a perceptual illusion, they say.
Right.
We feel like language is rhythm, but that's just the way we think it is, and in fact it isn't. Maybe Japanese, but.
Hmm.
So this, it seems to me like this could actually define it in a way that would be rigorous.
Right.
Finally, you know, it's
right.
What this thing finds.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
It's what this device finds. That's what I mean by rhythm in language,
right.
Is the thing that this thing is doing.
Right. And like as a completely sideline, like I sort of see this. If you look at Grossberg's stuff on speech perception, he uses his art model to do a lot of what I'm talking about. But one of the things that's always bothered me about his models is that he has this sort of just a factor that's in the model that is an indication of the speaking rate. And it's just not at all, it has always kind of looked like a hack to me, because all it's essentially doing is modulating. He's kind of measuring, he's in some ways it's very similar in that he's sort of measuring the intervals of God, I can't speak today. He's measuring, he's sort of counting the number of vocalic intervals in a period and then modulating the speed at which his window is sliding across the signal.
For different languages or for just English?
I think he only does English.
That sounds, yeah.
Which, so it would,
it's okay if only doing this. It's
right.
The only language that really matters.
Matters.
So.
It's universal.
Well, have this ready by the time he comes in April and be able.
And
to
then be able to.
Yeah.
To
tell
it at him
what he does is a hack and what he should be doing.
No, but see, I'm seeing this as kind of being like a good sort of substrate to which for a lot of the stuff that he's talking about. Because I don't think that he's wrong about what he's saying. I just think that I'm bothered by that one aspect,
yeah,
of what he does. Oh, the other thing I was going to say too is that this also, as you speed up your speaking rate, there's going to be, by definition, you're shortening periods, which is going to shorten the variance. Your variance is going to shrink at the same time, which means your windows are going to shrink simultaneously. So it's not only adaptive to speaking rate, but that also has implications for things like when you have this. If in English you start speaking faster and your window starts narrowing, you're going to have to start dumping stuff out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, my favorite example is probably,
mm-hmm. Well, yeah,
which, like, half the time drops right down to Prawley, and I've actually seen people starting to write it that way, too.
Well, there are people
who
say Pry.
Pry.
And it depends on their speaking rate, but
right. And so I think that's a nice, it's another kind of side benefit that I don't have any like rigorous thing to say about that yet, but it's a nice kind of coincidence.
But it would be interesting to then look and see whether there are these more of these effects in languages of English, of the English type.
Right.
More of these Sunday things.
Right. Right. So that's what I'm hoping to do.
One more question.
Yep.
In your Japanese case, what would the size of window be? Would it be the size of one vowel or?
More size. I would argue that because Japanese is more periodic.
Right, but what about those things that I talked about that were two more rather than?
Oh, right. So, importantly, because if you've got a distribution that sort of looks like this, with a level distinction between this, if it entrains on, because statistically this is much stronger, what will happen, I would predict, is when you have a particularly long vowel, it'll produce two, that oscillator is just going to produce two of them, and sort of gloss over it.
But like what we were saying the other day, the language would have to be such that the great majority of vowels are not long. Otherwise, the device won't train itself on that length.
Right.
If you have roughly equal frequencies of these longer ones and the shorter ones, the system is going to get...
Then you're not going to... I would predict that you would not be able to have a Mora language, even though you have long versus short contrast.
That's what you're guessing about finish, right?
Right. That's what I was...
You're guessing about finish as well. That
is that finish is... And this is totally speculative. I would suspect that Finnish has a more even distribution of long versus short vowels.
It's not more... what kind of timing does it have?
I think it's...
Syllable.
Really? I think it's syllable. Because
it also has long consonants.
Right.
It has geminated consonants and long and short vowels, and both seem to be pretty frequent.
Right.
Which is like...
Right. And that's what I would expect.